content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book called Silver Linings, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. To begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, we travel back to October 2018, when Hurricane Michael swept through central and northeastern North Carolina. As the storm bore down on the city of Greensboro, writer Elizabeth Hudson recalls how she rediscovered the season of light. Her essay is found in her book Silver Linings, which is published by Our State Magazine. Miss Hudson is the editor. The electricity flickered at first, then went off altogether, extinguished by Hurricane Michael, which felled 100-year-old trees in Greensboro and tangled power lines and plunged most of the city into darkness for days. The house fell into an eerie silence, so accustomed am I to the ambient hum of the refrigerator, the click of the thermostat in the background, the whir of the ceiling fan, sounds we don't notice at all until they are no longer there. I rummaged for candles and a camping lantern and set about bringing as much light into the house as I could to stave off a darkness made even darker without the evening glow of street lights, without the neighbor's porch light that's always on. My mother, who lives up the road from me, got out her battery-powered window candles, the ones she and my dad always put in the center of the windowsills in our house in Ashboro at Christmas time. And even though we were still a few months away from Christmas, I felt better knowing that my mother wasn't entirely in the dark either. My dad loved those lights in the windows. He was a photographer, a studier of light, and at Christmas he made our house glow. He wrapped strands of white lights up the staircase banister and strung lights along the fireplace mantel. In our dining room, he set up a small tree lit with multicolored lights and used a half dozen cords of lights on the tree in the living room, 1,000 lights or more on our 6-foot tree. He lit pillar candles on the kitchen table and set out votives in the bathrooms. And on the coffee table, my dad assembled our Swedish brass angel chime. 4 candles in the base gave off enough heat to spin a triangle of angels that rang a bell. My parents bought that decoration more than 40 years ago at the old General Hardware in Ashboro when they moved into their first house along with their first sets of ornaments for the tree. The angel chime was my favorite of all our decorations because of the way the brass glinted into a tiny halo of candlelight, the way the chime emitted its delicate ting. At night, when my dad turned off the television and the lamps in the den before bed, he and my mom would sit for a while, talking and enjoying the glow of all those lights, catching a quiet moment for themselves, a silent night made luminous and warm. "I wish it could stay like this," he told her. When the power returned to Greensboro several days after the big storm, I walked over to check on my mom. She hadn't put those candle lights away yet. "I might as well keep them out," she said. "Christmas is coming, and when it does, she'll put up a small tree, fewer lights than what my dad would have done, but enough to allay the darkness. She'll line the fireplace mantle with lights, and she'll put out that Swedish angel chime and light its 4 candles, and it'll make the 2 of us so happy to see it spin, our Christmas memories still burning bright." Well, our thanks to Elizabeth Hudson for providing some holiday cheer to begin this episode of Armchair Traveler. And a reminder that her book, Silver Linings, is a collection of essays, and they have appeared in Our State Magazine. Her themes often touch on unique places to visit and enjoy in North Carolina, as well as some personal experiences in some of those locations. Well, like many of us, travel writer Stephanie Rosenblum has achieved fewer miles in the past year because of the coronavirus pandemic. Despite the setback, she has discovered another way to be transported to remote places like Mexico, Italy, Montana, and beyond. She says all you have to do is listen. Her article, Traveling by Ear, 13 podcasts for wandering souls, appeared in the April 9th, 2020 issue of the New York Times. For most travelers nowadays, home is the only destination. Yet, thanks to some imaginative podcast, you can still explore the world. The following were selected because, rather than focus on such things as miles and points, they're transportive, rife with the sounds of cities and wilderness, conversations with creative thinkers, and ways to change your life through adventure and language learning. So don some noise-canceling headphones and pick your favorite audio platform, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. Soon you'll be hearing birdsong in Tuscany, rain falling in the English countryside, and wind rustling trees in Paris as you ride a scooter along the Champs-Élysées. National Parks is our first destination. The National Park Service oversees some of the most breathtaking places in America and has several podcasts aimed at taking you along amid redwoods and supervolcanoes, beneath constellations and dark desert skies. Different podcasts, some old but nonetheless engaging, explore the varied histories, landscapes, and wildlife of some of the most visited parks. The geyser basins of Yellowstone, the trails of the Grand Canyon, the Going to the Sun Road across the Continental Divide and Glacier National Park. There are also themed podcasts that examine subjects like Native American tribes, archaeology, volcanoes, plants and animals, from banana slugs to grizzly bears. To find the various podcasts, your best bet is to go to Apple Podcast or go on Apple Podcast and search for National Park Service. Again, that's National Park Service. Then we have the Bowery Boys. Stroll New York sidewalks, past and present, with this podcast that explores the city's beloved neighborhoods, Greenwich Village, Harlem, and the Lower East Side, among others. Buildings and historical figures, be it Harry Houdini or Edgar Allan Poe. Even lifelong New Yorkers hunkering down at home are likely to discover things they never knew about their city, with episodes about bagels, taxis, Fifth Avenue mansions, Coney Island, and one of Manhattan's newest areas, Hudson Yards. Now we have a coffee break. For those who have long wanted to learn a language but never had the time, the present moment may be just right. If so, the Coffee Break podcast from Radio Lingua Network for languages such as Spanish, French, Italian, German, Swedish, and Chinese offer free lessons that increase in difficulty. The offerings vary from language to language. Take German, for instance. There are two seasons, beginners and intermediate, and a magazine podcast meant to build upon the intermediate German lessons. Chinese and Swedish currently have one lesson each for beginners. Again, you can just check on those at Coffee Break is the name of the podcast. Now we deviate with Rolf Potts. Before there were digital nomad and van life hashtags, people like Rolf Potts, the author of Vagabonding, were traveling the world, rarely staying put for long. Conversations on his podcast include talks with fellow travel writers, musing about their craft and life on the road, like Pico Liar discussing the beauty of impermanence and other lessons from Japan, and Paul Thoreau talking about Mexico, magical realism, and what makes good travel writing. If this sounds appealing, you may also want to check out another podcast, The Big Travel, where guests have included the designer India Hicks, the actress and writer Carol Drinkwater, and the astronaut John Harrington. Let's dream of Italy next. Scenes of piazzas, arcaded streets, and markets float through this podcast with Kathy McCabe, the host of the PBS Dream of Italy series. There are just a handful of episodes, though they evoke a sense of place, particularly those with Francis Mays, the author of the novel Under the Tuscan Sun, who talks about the slow life in the Italian countryside. Then we have Duolingo. Millions of people use the popular Duolingo app to learn foreign languages for free, with quick and simple lessons and quizzes. Those learning to speak French and Spanish can supplement their lessons with these podcasts, which offer short, true stories, mostly in the language you're striving to master. And by the way, she adds, students may find it helpful to look at the transcripts, which are found at podcast.duolingo.com. Duolingo is Duolingo, podcast.duolingo.com. Next, we have the, get this, Earful Tower. Wherever you are in the world, forget about that now. Close your eyes and imagine that you are being transported into the 8th arrondissement of Paris, says Oliver G., the Australian expat host of this podcast about life in the City of Light. It's not hard to imagine being transported to Paris while listening to such an episode, for example, Season 7, Episode 8, where you hear Mr. G driving his scooter along the Champs-Élysées, stopping to visit the Petit Palais, walking past the Hotel Plaza Athénée, and then having lunch at Arsène in the Galerie Lafayette, Champs-Élysées, amid the background chatter of fellow diners, before arriving at La Durée and receiving a macaroon recommendation, vanilla, from a bartender there. Expect tourists of the artistic and culinary pleasures of the city, and interviews with its inhabitants, the French model Caroline de Maigret, the chef David Leibovitz, cafe owners, even a bouquiniste selling books beside the Seine. Then we travel on to the Frommer's Travel Show. It was in 1957 when Arthur Frommer first published his guide, Europe on $5 a Day, and in the years since, the Frommer name has become synonymous with travel. With charisma and candor, he and his daughter, Pauline Frommer, co-president of Frommer Media and editorial director of Frommer's Guidebooks, discuss the charms and ongoing transformations of places near and far, whether on the islands of Hawaii or on safari in Tanzania. Our ninth selection is the National Trust Podcast. Ride a bus through Liverpool to visit the childhood homes of the Beatles. Wander through the Dorset countryside to the cottage where T.E. Lawrence, also known as Lawrence of Arabia, took refuge. Escape to the house and gardens in Devon, where Agatha Christie went for holidays and found inspiration for some of her best-known detective stories. These dreamy places are part of the National Trust, a conservation charity founded in 1895 that looks after hundreds of historic properties, gardens, coastlines, and nature reserves across Britain. While you may not be able to visit in person, you can trail podcast hosts as they walk toward the front doors of great old houses, listening to the sound of the ground crunching underfoot and the occasional countryside downpour soaking the earth. Travel with Rick Steves is number 10. While many travelers first got to know Rick Steves as an affable guide on public television, this podcast highlights his gift for conjuring with just a few poetic words, the romance of places as varied as Dracula's Romania, Monet's Gardens in Giverny, and Jack Kerouac's Fire Lookout in the Cascades Mountain Range. Then we have Disney. If you'd rather be in the Magic Kingdom, you're not alone. There are a number of podcasts dedicated to Disney parks, cruises, and lore. The WDW radio show includes history, trivia, reviews, and interviews. Disney diehards may also want to try unlocking the magic, mostly about the goings-on in the Orlando parks. The Disney Story Origins podcast, stories and fairy tales behind favorite Disney characters and films, and Miles to Go, the emphasis is on travel, news, and tips, but there are several Disney episodes because the host, Edward Pizzarello, is a true blue fan. And then we have at number 12, Wild Ideas Worth Living. If you've ever had a passing thought about doing something different with your days or ticking an item off your bucket list, this podcast offers plenty of inspiration. Episodes feature people who chose roads less traveled, pursued dreams, and overcame obstacles, including the professional rock climber Alex Honnold, known for his free solo accents, Cheryl Strayed, the author of Wild, the chef Salman Nasrat of Netflix's Salt Fast Acid Heat, and the first person to swim from Cuba to Florida without a shark cage, Diana Nyad, who pulled it off at age 64. Those in search of ideas may also want to try The Jump, with Traveling Jackie podcast, where Jackie Norris, founder of the Budget-Minded Traveler blog, talked with fellow travelers about taking the plunge, whether to learn French in a small town in France or to walk the Kumano Kodo pilgrimage routes solo in Japan. And number 13, Star Talk Radio. For those who want to travel beyond Earth, Neil deGrasse Tyson, an astrophysicist and the director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, navigates this journey into outer space with episodes that talk about black holes, the North Star's role in navigation, and what lies beyond the edge of the universe. He's also often joined by widely known guests Al Gore, Salman Rushdie, Jane Goodall, and shares morsels with cosmic wonks, including the saying that's not uncommon among astronomers and optimists, keep looking up. So there you go, a little podcast traveling for you. Well, it's no secret that off the coast of Cape Hatteras lie hundreds of wrecks dating from the Civil War era to post-World War II. This lured writer John Briley to travel off the North Carolina shore for a deep dive into history. His article was published in the September 18, 2020 issue of the Washington Post. Let's see what he's discovered. This ain't resort diving. I'm on the phone with Dave Somers, asking about booking a scuba dive on a shipwreck off Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. And Somers is stressing that wreck diving in the open Atlantic is a step up from finning along nearshore coral reefs, and that neither he nor his crew will babysit clients underwater. Basically, I'd better know what I'm doing. On the one hand, I do. I have an advanced open water scuba certification from the Professional Association of Diving Instructors, and dozens of dives to my credit, including the six or so in the past year. On the other hand, all of those were near shore, mostly on coral reefs and guided by dive masters, people whose job it is to look out for their clients' safety. Still, I'm a strong swimmer, comfortable in the ocean, and old enough not to ignore a seasoned expert like Somers. After I share all of this with him, he agrees to take me on. The fact is, I didn't need Somers to provide a sobering take on wreck diving. The author, Robert Kersen, had already accomplished that through his gripping nonfiction book, Shadow Divers, about a mission to identify a mysterious wreck that lay in 230 feet of cold, dark water, 60 miles off New Jersey. Everything about that account, the wreck, the conditions, the divers, their persistence and preparation, and despite all that, the number of things that went wrong, imprinted on me the stakes of open ocean diving. I've wanted to dive off Hatteras ever since I heard it was a thing. There are hundreds of wrecks in the area, dating from the Civil War era to post-World War II. Dozens are in diveable range because of a confluence of factors, chief among them, that a major north-south shipping lane passes close to the Cape. Before the advent of electronic navigation, many ships succumbed to storms, shifting shoals, the vexing collision of the northern Labrador and southern Gulf currents, or, during World Wars I and II, German submarines. But I always had other priorities in the Outer Banks, wind, waves, and beach time, and I resisted the advance commitment needed to secure a spot on a dive boat. That changed this summer when my family and I booked 2 consecutive weeks on Hatteras Island, a stanza that allowed me to dive with minimal FOMO on other activities. Even better, my sister Gina, also a recreational diver with no wreck experience, agreed to join me on the day trip. We meet Somers at his 42-foot Duffy, the Lion's Paw, at a Soundside dock in Hatteras Village on a hot Friday morning in early July. Somers, in his second career after 35 years as a Fairfax County cop, looks like Magnum P.I. Jimmy Buffett mashed up, his graying mustache offset by blue-patterned swim trunks, unbuttoned fishing shirt, sun hat, and aviator shades. 4 other divers are joining us, Joe Stradley from Windsor, Virginia, David Metacarpa from Charlton, New York, and a father-son duo, Eugene and Jude Link, from Seaford, Virginia, who are relatives of Somers' first mate, Mark Corbett. All are experienced, although Metacarpa concedes he's only done a couple of wreck dives. Somers and Corbett fit Gina and me with gear. We'd brought only masks, snorkels, and fins, while the other divers arrived with full kits, including air tanks, before our captain runs through the safety briefing, which includes manage your own gear, bottom time and decompression stops, and descend and ascend hand over hand by the anchor line to avoid getting swept away by currents. If you do get separated, get to the surface safely. Inflate your signaling device, neon tubes that are visible from a great distance away, and don't panic. I'll find you, Somers says, but don't let it come to that. The record is 4 miles, and you don't want to break it. The rest of the briefing was about coronavirus precautions. Wear a mask in the cabin, be respectful of other people's space, handle only your own gear, use hand sanitizer often, and don't look for the community rinse bucket, a staple on dive boats for quickly desalting masks, snorkels, and camera housings, because Summers removed it. He describes himself as a COVID believer, and an extensive section on risk and responsible behavior on his website supports the claim. Our trip is his first with clients in 2020. As he steers us through the shoals and buoys of Pamlico Sound toward Hatteras Inlet, a pod of dolphins appears off our starboard side, ripping through the small swells with sinewy efficiency. To port, Hatteras Island narrows toward its southern tip, with lime-hued marsh grasses, patches of maritime forest, and hyphens of sand alight in the morning sun. After we pass between Hatteras and Ocracoke Islands, Somers leans on the throttle, and the lion's paw rears its bow toward the horizon. 80 minutes later, and 2 hours after leaving dock, we slow to an idle on a milky blue sea, a tropical hue created by our proximity to the Gulf Stream. We're 8 miles off the beach of Ocracoke and 90 feet above the wreck of the Dixie Arrow, a 468-foot tanker that was torpedoed by a German U-boat on March 26, 1942, at the height of World War II. According to the informative website nc-wreckdiving.com, the tanker was approaching Cape Hatteras en route from Texas City, Texas, to Paulsboro, New Jersey, with 96,000 barrels of crude oil. The U-71 had spent the night waiting near the Diamond Shoals light buoy, hoping to intercept targets. With the breaking dawn, the U-boat captain, K.K. Walter Fleschenberg, was about to order his boat to the bottom when he spotted the mast of the approaching tanker on the horizon. The site's account of the incident reads, "The first torpedo hit at the midship deckhouse, destroying it and killing most of the deck officers. 60 seconds later, the second and third torpedoes hit just aft of the deckhouse and cracked the tanker in two." Such details are a draw for wreck divers, offering a connection to the dive site and a slew of facts and trivia, mental snack food for a community already prone to nerding out on gear, dive travel, and the life-or-death math of their sport. For the moment, I'm connected to one goal: get suited up and in the water before I hurl. I rarely get seasick, but I also rarely stand on the deck of a motorboat for 2 straight hours, bucking over ocean swells while whiffs of diesel fumes taint the sea air. But really, it's mostly luck of the draw. The swell is a reasonable 3 to 4 feet, and none of the others seem the least bit bothered. We are far out of sight of any land, but not alone. There's a smaller dive boat already positioned over the Dixie's bow, so Somers parks over the stern and drops anchor. Corbett is getting ready to splash and set the granny line, a horizontal cable about 15 feet deep, so named for its ease of use, which we'll use to pull ourselves over the anchor line before descending to the wreck. He'll also tie a line from our anchor line to the wreck as added insurance against the lion's paw drifting away. Just before taking that giant stride, I look around at the sun glinting off the endless swells, the everythingness, nothingness, and vast loneliness of the open ocean, and take a deep breath to settle my stomach and my nerves. As soon as I reach the seafloor, my anxiety recedes into the familiarity and thrill of the sport. There's a current sweeping away from the Dixie Arrow, but it's manageable. The corroded, encrusted remains of the tanker loom from the sand, but my eyes are drawn first to the clouds of fish, snappers, amberjacks, African pompanos, cleaner wrasses, Atlantic spadefish, and more, a density of free-swimming life to rival most coral reefs. The fish are here because of the wreck. The visibility is excellent, not aquarium clarity, but far better than I expected. The same currents that can carry off a diver can also stir up sand and sediment, but for the moment, we're in luck. Still towering from the Dixie Arrow's stern are three hulking boilers, and Gina and I linger there, taking in the silhouette of man's audacious engineering against the haunting relief of the endless blue beyond. We work slowly along the port side of the ship, which, thanks to salt currents, storms, and time, more resembles a vaguely contiguous mound of rubble than a distinct section of the vessel. While all ocean wrecks will eventually dissolve, some are still enough intact that divers can swim well into the interior and sometimes find decades or centuries-old artifacts. And worldwide, there's a modest community of divers who live for the fleeting moments of the hunt because of how the human body responds to pressure and processes compressed air at depth. Safely advisable bottom time decreases the deeper you go, so, as in the case of the crew and shadow divers, someone hoping to explore a wreck at 230 feet might have only 10 minutes to do so before heading back up. Bad things can happen on any dive, even within seemingly benign nearshore sites. But, as Stradley will tell me later, when I catch up with him by phone to fill some gaps in my reporting, deep, open ocean diving is a different animal. He's returning from another Dixie Arrow dive, one in which a sudden spike in wind caused the Lion's Paw anchor line to pull free from the wreck. Fortunately, while all the divers were close enough to recognize what was happening and return to the boat, we're in 90 feet of water and thus have 40 minutes of bottom time. Since I'm not here to solve a historical mystery, I take a look at all the pretty fish approach. Gina and I kick over the cluttered, decaying deck to starboard as two massive Atlantic stingrays cruise beneath us and a 4-foot barracuda hovers above. We then head along the wreck into the current, which will set up an easy coast back to the anchor line later. But in the time we have left, we don't even make it amidships, where the fateful torpedo bisected the hull 78 years ago. Back on board for our safety interval, time budgeted between dives to allow our bodies to outgas nitrogen, I lie down on a cushioned bench in the cabin, barely clinging to my equilibrium as the others swap stories. For our second and final dive of the day, Somers had initially intended to take us to the Proteus, a 390-foot luxury liner that sunk in 1918 after colliding with another ship, but with the superb visibility on the Dixie Arrow, he decides to stay put. Unfortunately, despite zero change in the surface conditions, when we get back to the Dixie, the visibility has deteriorated. We can still see the ship's remains and the abundant sea life, but a gauzy layer of sand mutes the view. Such are the whelms of Poseidon. Besides, the change gives the setting an approximately eerie mine or mien. I peer into the void, hoping for one of the large animals that are common here, a shark, manta ray, or Goliath grouper, to materialize, but none do. Stradley later says he once saw 27 sand tiger sharks together off the bow of this wreck. Our most unusual sighting is a toadfish, a cantankerous-looking creature almost completely camouflaged in a rusty pocket of the wreck. In the end, I find Peak Zen drifting through clouds of fish, humbled by their numbers, their graceful movements, and their dazzling beauty. When our time is up, we kick and hurriedly back to the anchor line and climb, hand over hand, toward the sun. By the way, our writer is based in Tacoma Park, Maryland, and his website is johnbriley.com. So if you want to follow more of his adventures, that's John Briley, B-R-I-L-E-Y, johnbriley.com. And thank you, John, for that adventure, and thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Armchair Traveler. That's it for today's journey. Hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.